Hello, I'm Anushka Astana, the Observer's policy editor, and joining me today for a debate on the ethics of assisted suicide, we have in the studio Baroness Warnock, one of the country's most respected philosophers, and author of Easeful Death, Is There a Case for Assisted Dying? David Morris, who chairs Independent Living Alternatives, which promotes the rights of disabled people to live independently, and who has spinal muscular atrophy. And Baroness Finlay, who is a Professor of Palliative Care and Chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Dying Well. Joining us on the phone, we have Debbie Purdy, who has multiple sclerosis and has taken her campaign to clarify the laws on assisted suicide to the House of Lords. Welcome, everyone. Last week, the issue of laws around assisted dyings made headlines when one mother, Kay Gilderdale, walked free from court with a suspended sentence after helping her sick daughter to end her life with morphine. Lynn Gilderdale, who was 31 and suffered with ME, had attempted suicide and had contemplated going to Dignitas, the Swiss clinic where more than 100 Britons have been aided in their suicides. In the same week, another mother, Frances Inglis, was jailed for murder to serve a minimum of 9 years after injecting her brain-damaged son, Thomas, with a lethal dose of heroin. Thomas had never indicated a wish to die, but his mother believed he was in pain and it was what he would have wanted. Baroness Finlay, I'm going to start with you and just ask about what something you once said, which was you described the law as having a stern face and a kind heart. I just want to, in the context of these two cases, ask you what you mean by that.
What I mean is that the law sets a very clear line. We do not kill other people. And when people are suicidal and feeling suicidal, we have a duty in our society to try to help and support them as people, and we have suicide prevention strategies across society. Now, sadly, in our society, there are about 3,000 suicides a year, every year anyway, despite us having suicide prevention strategies. So the law gives a very clear message. You do not deliberately end another person's life. The way the law is interpreted, though, by whether to prosecute, and indeed if a prosecution occurs, and in this context we're talking about assisted suicide, we're not talking about murder, and that's a whole different area, I think. Right. Then we're saying that the way that the law has the flexibility for interpreting means that each case can be looked at on its merits. The Director of Public Prosecutions is able to look at it against two tests. Firstly, is there evidence? And secondly, is it in the public interest to proceed with the prosecution? And one of the things I think that must come into that is really, is the safety of the public going to be served well by proceeding with the prosecution? Where that becomes important is one of the other questions linked to that is that person going to be a risk to others? And so it depends where they may be working and so on. And that's been reflected in the list. But that interpretation occurs over prosecution. And then the courts as well, even when they deliver a verdict, can deliver a suspended sentence. And indeed, that has been the trend that we've seen with assisted suicide. Even when people have been found guilty of assisting a suicide, then there has been often a suspended sentence, which means that it's basically the person is out there, but obviously they don't do it again.
Right. And you're talking about the public interest defence, which the Director of Public Prosecutions published late last year, the kind of areas in which the public interest might come into play. Now, Debbie, the reason that we got those guidelines was a lot to do with your own case. I mean, can you talk a little bit about it and how you feel about those guidelines?
Well, I think the guidelines aren't sufficient to give a strong enough framework or enough safeguards, but they're the best that can be done with the current law as it exists, because our DPP does not have the power, neither should he, to change the law. And I think that is the problem, that the things that have happened in the last few weeks in particular, they show us that there is a need with the British legal system to differentiate clearly between a malicious decision to end somebody's life and a compassionate, caring assistance for somebody who has made an absolutely unequivocal decision that they want to end their life. One of the things that I would say very strongly is that I agree that we need to make sure that alternatives are available. But in my personal case, for instance, the thought that somebody could be prosecuted for helping me to carry out a decision that I had made means that I am, if I believe that that prosecution is probable or possible to encounter, I would end my life early. And it might not be necessary, you know, I might never find myself in a situation where I want to end my life, but I need the security of knowing that if I make a decision, as you know, if I've explored alternatives, if I've looked at ways of improving the quality of my life, of maintaining my life in a way that is acceptable to me, and I can't find that I can ask somebody for help.
And Debbie, you're talking your case. You've often talked about your husband and wanting to have some clear guidance because, you know, to protect him. So you don't feel that these guidelines go far enough in giving you that protection?
We haven't seen the final guidelines yet because they won't be published until March. I think there needs to be some things that are not totally clear in the guidelines that the DPP has published. For instance, he talks about him being, you know, there being more likely to be a prosecution if somebody is going to benefit from the death of a person. Well, what about me? My husband and I own a house together. If I die, it becomes his. Is that considered financial benefit or not?
Can I just turn to David here? Because one of the issues that it kind of points that he's argued on in the past are that people in your position who have these very obvious, clear feelings and desires are in the minority, and that there's a larger number of people who could be potentially vulnerable. Can you just talk a bit?
I think we need to make some very clear distinctions. And one of the things about looking at legislating is that actually we have to start drawing in laws some lines. One of the things that I know, and I really share very much what Debbie feels around choice and control as a disabled person. What I don't want to see, though, is us being placed in a context where some of our lives are of less value in the eyes of the law and in the eyes of society than others. And there's a whole depth of debate which we need to have, which is both ethical, but is also very practical. That I'm very, before we legislate for death, we should be ensuring that we all, as disabled people, have access to these supports to be able to live effectively. What I know at the moment is that my impairments would allow me, without any question, if I felt suicidal, and I happened to say last year, for various reasons, I was feeling suicidal, but nothing to do with my impairment, but my experience of a disabled person within an abusive system, that I could have gone to Dignitas and nobody would have said anything about me being assisted to die. Because I'm judged as somebody with an impairment which changes and confused with somebody who is terminally ill. And we really need to establish that point.
So the kind of definition, I mean, terminal illness is something which they talk about in the guidelines as, you know, an area in which they might not prosecute.
The guidelines are confused with, as far as I'm concerned, in relation to somebody who has an impairment which may last for an awful long time, that has issues which might be similar to somebody with a terminal illness. Now, I would not be able physically to slash my wrists. I might, if I was suicidal, I can make the choice to walk out in front of a bus, which I can do, but I might ethically think that if I wanted to end my life, I wouldn't want to involve somebody else. And then it comes into the assistance process. But I don't feel that as a disabled person, I should be being treated less than anybody else that might wish to commit suicide. And we will not let, you know, if for the majority of people, the concept that somebody is in a suicidal state, we provide support for them to move away from it. What we're saying here, and it's very subtle, which is why I'm concerned as a historian, particularly looking at the eugenics movement, that some people's quality of life is of less value, therefore it's okay that we end their lives.
Okay. Now, Can I ask, just to let you know also, we've been joined in the studio by Evan Harris, the Liberal Democrat MP. Mary, can I just come to you first and just say, could you respond to what David was saying?
I think it's terribly important to listen to what David and other disabled people say, and I'm sure that they quite often have reason to think that they're not treated fairly. It's rather like being terribly old. One feels that the medical profession tend to think it's not worth doing anything for her because she's so aged. And so they might think it's not worth doing anything for David because he's disabled anyway. But I think we shouldn't confuse that at all with the possibility of changing the law on assisted suicide in very specific cases. And I think that the cases that came up this week, a very different one from another, very different. And it does a great danger in confusing them and even talking about them together, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, I think we must keep very clearly in mind what those people who campaign for changing the law on assisted suicide really have in mind. And it is people who are terminally ill. I mean, the clearest case of all is when their illness is progressive and has got much worse and is going to get worse, and they wish not to get to the very end stage of that. And those are the people that I, at any rate, have in mind. And it's nothing to do with disability whatsoever. It's to do with the prospect of becoming even iller than they are now. So, as a matter of fact, neither of the cases this week, as far as I can understand, fall absolutely squarely into that category. But they obviously are of great interest to those who want to change the law. What happened, I think, as far as I understand it, and I may be wrong, in the case of Lynn, was that her mother reluctantly, acceded to her request to help her to die, she having attempted suicide unsuccessfully in the past. And her mother obviously knew her and knew that she'd made up her mind. But her mother was brought to court for assisting her daughter to commit suicide, and pleaded guilty. So she confessed, so to speak, to having assisted suicide, knowing that that was against the law. But there was no... the maximum penalty for that is 14 years, but there's no minimum penalty. Then she was convicted, I mean, she was brought to court again for attempted murder. Now, had she been brought to court for murder, that would have been a mandatory life sentence. And this is something which judges are very reluctant to hand down. So, in fact, she was on a sort of technicality, I think, accused of attempted murder, for which there's no mandatory life sentence. So the judge was given flexibility. But the thing that seems to me most important of all about this case is this, that it was the jury who unanimously and after a very short time decided to find her not guilty. And the judge obviously agreed with that. But I think the fact that it was the jury is very important because the jury represents ordinary people.
Okay. So, Evan, if I could just bring you in here. I mean, I suppose one argument that people could make is that that there are protections in the law, and then actually of the over 100 people, I think, who've been to Dignitas, none of them have been prosecuted. What's your feeling about
Well, there are protections in the current law, of course, for those people who don't want to go to Dignitas at the time that they are physically able to,
right,
but who actually want to live as long as possible but still want the option when they're terminally ill and suffering unbearably by their own terms and are mentally competent to seek to die with dignity at a time of their own choosing. Now, so you've heard from Debbie. She wants the right to have help in this country at a time of her choosing, not be forced to go abroad perhaps earlier than she would otherwise go when she's physically able to do that. But I do want to pick up the point that David raised about the suggestion that those of us calling for a change in the law are in any way suggesting that that the lives of disabled people are of less value. I happen to be very clear that the criteria that I would wish to see a change in the law in relate to terminally ill people. I wouldn't extend it.
How do you define
to,
that? Well, I mean, that's one thing that David's brought
medical
up.
Medical diagnosis can be given that someone's terminally ill. I'm, as a doctor, I know people who are terminally ill. I know people who are not terminally ill, like the case of the man who was a tetraplegic after a rugby injury. He's not terminally
Daniel
ill.
James.
And I wouldn't have supported a change in the law, don't support a change in the law that would capture him. But it's not about lives of less value. It's actually giving people who are terminally ill the right to have their autonomy respected. And often people are infantilised when they're seriously ill, and you know that what they say doesn't count. What we're actually saying is that we will listen to the views of the competent, terminally ill person. And it's also, I understand why disabled people, because they've been treated so badly, want to say, let's not have any change in the law until we get proper support and proper facilities. But it isn't an either-or. I'm strongly supportive of the right and the requirement on government and social services to provide the sort of support that enable disabled people to live full lives, as many of them do. And that's a separate question from whether we should respect the autonomy of other people.
Laura, I'm going to get you to respond to that. And just once again, can I just ask what you would like the law to be, you know, what kind of change in law you're looking for?
Well, I'd like to see, instead of the hodgepodge situation we have where the Director of Public Prosecutions sort of gives an indication of who may or may not be prosecuted, our laws are too wide at the moment. Assisted suicide laws cover people that juries won't convict and juries will convict, people who are helping people assisting suicide where that's clearly wrong, the mentally ill who need treatment, and those who are not mentally ill. Debbie Purdy is not mentally ill. She knows her own mind. And I would like the law changed specifically to permit assisted suicide, subject to safeguards, including, very importantly, that there's mental competence, that there's no coercion, that someone is terminally ill, and that they're suffering. And in those circumstances, we can ensure that everything outside of that is very clearly seen to be unacceptable, a criminal offence, and clamped down on. That isn't happening at the moment. I think juries would be much more likely to convict if there was a legal way that people could go through the proper process with those safeguards.
OK, Ilora.
Can I just come back on the terminal illness thing?
Yes.
Because I think it's a fallacy to say that you can define when someone's terminally ill. I look after these patients, have looked after many, many thousands of them. We have patients who people have thought were terminally ill. The diagnosis has been wrong. The prognosis has been wrong. And there have been other things that can be done. And they are alive years later and really glad. Some of those had at the time been desperate to die and felt that really they had no future and had spoken and asked about dying and assisted suicide or euthanasia. The other thing is that I would completely agree with David that sadly we have a society in which people do have to fight for resources, in which there are delays in people getting what they need. And whilst you might say you personally don't concur with that view, there are value judgments made. There are value judgments made in the health service, in the care of the country, and we face financial stringency. And it is only too easy to look at rationing and saying some lives are more worthwhile than others. And I think we have to be realistic about that. The law is there to protect people. And if you look at what happens in a society, in Oregon in the 10 years since they've changed their law, the number of assisted suicides has gone up fourfold. Now, if it had been exactly static when they brought their law in, you could say this is a small number, you don't have a change in society. If you look at what's happened in Holland now, the numbers have gone up, year on year, although they probably were beginning to get towards a plateau before they even changed their law during the time when they had non-prosecution. Something changes in society and the attitude of people changes that actually ending your life is not only a so-called choice, but is an option that you ought to consider early. And the other thing I would say is looking after these patients. Very often people are in complete despair at a time and say they think they would be better off dead. And that may last for a week or month or so. But I've been struck by all of those who say afterwards, I never believed I could have so much quality of life again. I never believed my days could be so rich. And it's only been when their problems and their anxieties and their fears have been addressed. But make no mistake, it costs money to do that properly.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, Debbie.
Okay. First of all, to say that the number of assisted deaths in Oregon have gone up fourfold sounds like there's so many of them. That last year, less than 100 people utilised the law on assisted dying. Every year in the United Kingdom, people who are suffering from incurable illnesses like multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, motor neurone disease, they commit suicide because they are frightened of the future. If we have in place a framework where people speak to their doctors and the doctors and social workers can look at ways of improving somebody's life, then that gives them protection, because the people who would be able to find solutions to change pain medication or to change the social circumstances somebody's in would then be part of that conversation. If somebody is not terminally ill or in unbearable pain immediately, like for instance Dan James, and not having known him, I don't want to cause any additional pain to his family by making comments, but if for instance we had a law and a framework in this country, Dan James could have spoken to a doctor and said, I think I want to die because I'm in unbearable pain, and the doctor would have been able to say, I'm not saying I won't help you, but I need you to do these things first, and maybe changed his focus from being one of, I've got to end my life, this is just unbearable, to being one of finding ways of dealing with the situation he found himself in.
Can I just explain the Daniel James case so that people know what we're talking about? That's all right. He was a 23-year-old who was paralysed in a rugby scrum and had made several suicide attempts, but finally persuaded his parents to take him to the Dignitas clinic. And his parents were questioned by police, but were not prosecuted.
I agree with everything David said, except not agreeing we need to change the law. If we don't like the fact that Swiss law is available to British citizens, we need to talk about what is appropriate for the United Kingdom and design a law, work out a law, consider all the possible pitfalls that people are frightened of, and design a law that is appropriate in the 21st century for the citizens of this country. At the moment, we use Switzerland, we have them wash our dirty laundry because we have nothing in this country. And as much as, because suicide is not illegal, the numbers of people who commit suicide because of fear of the future is quite high. If people felt they were able to talk to doctors about assisting in their deaths or whatever, then maybe a lot of those people wouldn't. And if the DPP had not come up with clarification, I would probably have already gone to Switzerland and or found a different way to die. I cannot open a bottle of tablets. I can't take tablets out of a blister pack. But I'm certainly not ready to die. I want to live in an independent and positive way. I want to be taken seriously. And I don't want resources that because a doctor decides certain resources should be used on me, because social services in the city council decide I must have this and I must do that in order to tick their boxes, that isn't taking into account my wishes. And I think that we need to, there are scarce resources, but we need not to waste them on situations where people don't want them, and rather direct them to ways they can be more used.
OK. David, can I ask you to respond to that?
I'm really interested in actually this whole area, and I think we've had a couple of chats, me and Debbie, and I think we have a lot of points of agreement. I think that one of the things that we're dealing with is something which is very, very complex. And personally, because I'm speaking as an individual disabled person that is engaged both practically and philosophically and historically with a lot of the debate that's going on. And I think that we need to recognise the complexity, that I think there is some way in which politics pushes us into places whereby we don't look at, because I think that the differentiation and definitions around terminal illness are very much about value judgments. I mean, my experience personally of some of the medical profession, and not all of the medical profession, and talking to people that have been in similar situations of utter desperation because of the positions that they're in. We need to have a way in which, if we are looking at sensible law, we need to have the debate that Debbie has pointed to about how we maximise the ability of all of us to develop all of our potential, and the place where we can all not have fear of future development, so that we have a structure which allows us to make choices that are right. You know, I would, you know, it's to me, it's a situation where somebody feels they have to die years before they need to because of fear of prosecution. It's something that we need to tackle, but we don't need to tackle by swift law changes. We need to look at the context. It's not just the context of Oregon and Netherlands. We need to look at these places very seriously. We also need to look at the background and the historical context of the eugenics movement, because this is a context where we have something that has developed over the years, which, and I'm sure none of us around the table would support anything that people were talking about 100 years ago.
No, indeed we wouldn't. And indeed, I think any mention of eugenics is a complete red herring, because that implies a government programme against the wishes of people, and whatever we might discuss and argue. Whatever we might discuss and argue about here, what we're talking about on our side of this discussion is respecting people's views. And what I can't understand about the idea that people might make a mistake because they might not be terminally ill, or they might be going through a phase of wanting this, is that those people are not arguing for stopping the thousands of people who choose to die by refusing treatment. We respect the autonomy of someone to die when they're not terminally ill, when they're not suffering unbearably. We don't do a check for coercion. There's barely a check for competence in many cases when they refuse treatment, invasive treatment or any treatment, and their autonomy is respected there. So if we were really concerned, as I think we should be, about making sure that people were given every chance to live, then there would be pressure to do something about that. But those who oppose us are not calling for that, as I think they should be, to be both consistent and to be concerned about that. And therefore it isn't about people making the wrong decision. It's usually about the unwillingness to allow people to make choices about their lives that are active rather than simply passive.
The whole of palliative care is about trying to help people make choices that are right for them to enhance the quality of their life as they have it, when they have it. That is hard work. The minute that you start saying that you can take shortcuts in care, or you can leave people or give them the impression that things can't be done for them, then you drive them further into despair. And so what you're presenting them with is not a choice about real choices in care and what they can have. You're giving them a choice of either staying in despair or being dead. And I would have to say, I don't think that is a choice. And I think there is huge danger. I'm not being paternalistic at all. I'm being realistic about shortcomings in clinical care.
But there are people who want to die for very many reasons. I mean, let's confine this to people who are either terminally ill or who have a long, long future of, let's say, total paralysis in front of them with no cure, those people may genuinely want to die. And I think there is such a thing as a wish to die. And part of this wish to die may be the wish not to become a burden to their families. Now, this is always put forward as a terrible
How
idea.
Do you protect those people?
Well, I mean, if all your life you've regarded yourself as a sort of provider for your families and looking after their interests, nothing could be more natural than wanting to die when the positions are reversed and you know that you are a burden to your families. And I just must say that I think you can want to die for partly, not entirely, but partly altruistic reasons, not to want to be in that position. And I just want that motive to be recognised as a respectable motive.
But can I just ask you, Mary, something that David and Ilora have brought up is this increase in numbers who have had assisted dying in areas where the law has changed. Do you believe there is a risk that culture changes in such a way that people feel under more pressure if you change the law?
I don't myself believe that, but there's no proof, no possibility of proof. I mean, what we're talking about is what may be an empirical fact, but we don't know because we can't foresee the future. I don't believe that those people who put up a spirited fight, as they always say, against their disease are going to diminish in number if the law is changed. There are lots of people who want to go on living whatever happens to them.
Can I say something on that, please?
Yes.
That the idea that somehow people are being encouraged to end their lives in Holland or Oregon, I think is incredibly insulting to the people of those states and those countries.
Absolutely,
that it's
Debbie.
Not the case. If you absolutely compare the people who use assisted dying legislation, are they people who would have otherwise attempted suicide and possibly botched it, possibly ended up in a worse state, possibly succeeded, whether they would have asked for help or not, maybe been a statistic of mercy killing or assisted suicide or suicide? Those things are important. That
we have no idea whether they are the same or different, and the concern is whether you subtly change the attitude in society. I'm not talking about the individual people, but whether you get a change in society.
Are you saying in Oregon that have had this legislation for 10 years that you think that maybe in Oregon they have a lower level that they expect their loved ones to choose to die or something? Are you saying that
I'm saying that when you look at the Oregon health reports, the numbers that are reported have gone up, and that's a fact. That's what you see. And you have to ask yourself why. And I have a concern that you take away the protection.
Debbie, just let Ilora finish.
Proper protected situation where they can explore, because the number of people who use legislation on assisted dying, 90-odd% of them come through the palliative care system, and they wouldn't have done beforehand, because that's when they talk to their doctor and say, I want to be assisted to end my life. Palliative care and hospice care is one of the things that is explored with everybody, which means that care at the end, surely this is something that the hospice movement and the palliative care movement should work hand in hand about, to make sure that the formation of a structure, the formal structure under a change in the law, means that everybody who approaches doctors or medical practitioners to ask for assistance, alternatives are explored, like palliative care.
Debbie, can I just ask Ilora to come back in on that, as that's your area of expertise?
Firstly, they don't have specialist palliative care in Oregon. It doesn't exist as a distinct specialty. Neither is it a distinct specialty. You have to look at where the concern is coming, and it's amongst the clinicians who look after these patients. There is no documenting of requests and what happens to those requests. All the data that you've got is after the event reporting. So the data that's coming out is really very poor. If you really want to know what happens, then you have to look at the number of people who request it, and then what happens to those requests, how those requests are screened at the time, not after the event, and how many proceed and so on. And I think we can talk theoretically, but the data just isn't there.
I think Ilora makes a good point here, that there would be a worry. I'm not in favour of legislation that opens the floodgate for unjustified cases of people who are either vulnerable or coerced, or for a change in the attitude that leads to that happening. We have every opportunity in this country to frame that law, and I just want to have the debate. I'd rather have the debate about the details of the framework to provide those assurances than the principle. But all actually on the data we have from those cases is a concern that because there's a new law and more people are using it, that that's a bad thing. Actually, if you believe, like me, that it's a human rights enhancing measure, I'm pleased that more people are using it and there's no clear evidence of abuse. And what comes out of Holland, and these figures are disputed, but since I have a chance to put some figures in, what comes out of Holland, in my view, is very clear evidence that since this was legalised and regulated, that involuntary euthanasia, right, essentially where doctors make a decision, and yeah, it happens in all countries because doctors are human, they make these decisions to bump up the amount of sedation so that it ends lives, that reduces. And I think it's right that that should reduce, because I don't want, in my case, doctors to make a decision for me, either when I'm incompetent or especially when I'm competent. And there is evidence that the number of non-voluntary deaths has decreased in those countries where there's a formal system that allows it to be carefully regulated.
David. Okay. Could I just ask you to come back on that point?
Yeah, okay, there's a couple of things. One is the practical example that speaks to me most about Oregon is the person that was offered assisted suicide as opposed to the drugs under Medicare, which and I think that is something that we need to consider. The other thing is that for me, we are talking about an area where we've got a lot of doubt, I feel sad when we sit around in a table and it becomes an us and them situation, because there is so much of common concern that we share. And I absolutely agree that we need to look very closely at how we would legislate, because I think that the worst law is law that is done quickly for motivations which are around, instead of a dialogue, a confrontation around an issue. And what we're talking about is an issue around rights. And I'm concerned that in any legislation, if we were to have legislation, that we legislate as strongly for the right to life as we legislate for the right to have a dignified death.
But what can I just, I mean, either yourself or Ilora on this, I mean, what do you say about the fact that so many people have been to Switzerland to, you know, where they can end their lives in this way?
You're talking about our population, which is quite large compared to the population of the other places that we were talking about. You're comparing over 57,000 suicides a year in the UK with about 100 in that same time period of people who've gone to Switzerland. When you look at the people who've gone to Switzerland, a lot of them weren't terminally ill. So this is, by any definition of terminal illness, I'd have to say. And so you really have to unpick this really carefully. And I would completely agree with David that we have to be very, very careful. The concern is, whose protection do we remove in pushing through something in legislation which looks like a fix to a problem, when actually we haven't really analysed the whole issues adequately to make sure that we don't have unintended consequences of removing safeguards from some people.
So what's the next step to analyse, you know, what is the next step then as part of this? What do we need to do?
I think that we have to get the provision of care right for people who need it. We have to make sure that we don't continue with people being assessed into the ground but not getting what they need in a timely manner. That we get beyond the point where people are having to fight for what they need to live fully. We've got an equality bill going through at the moment. And last night there was an amendment passed, which had been led by Jane Campbell, precisely to put a duty on everyone to help people live properly. We've got to get to that point in society where we have true equality of the value of life, and then we move on.
So Mary, well, can you respond to that?
I wouldn't possibly disagree with anything that Elora said, but I mean, it's hopeless at the moment. It's absolutely hopeless to suppose that we're going to move to a place where the whole of society is prepared to help people to live, but then allow them to die if they want to. This, I think, is a very important thing to add, because there's no doubt whatever that the financial constraints, especially on the health service, are absolutely terrible at the moment. And so doctors do make decisions to end people's lives, whether they want their lives ended or not.
In what way? Can you give examples of the type of thing you're talking about?
Well, I mean, most people die in hospital. And in hospital, it's very often a matter of a doctor's decision whether to attempt to resuscitate somebody if they have a heart attack, or whether to make sure that they get enough to eat, which is something which many people probably die of in hospital, of malnutrition, because they can't feed themselves. I mean, there are dozens of ways in which doctors do, knowingly or otherwise, make decisions that further treatment is futile. And that word futile, I think, carries a great deal of weight.
But there's a difference between that. That's the passive case. There's a difference between a decision not to resuscitate because it would be burdensome and or futile,
well,
usually
attempting,
both.
Attempting, because indeed, you're attempt, not going to
most
achieve
people
your end.
Don't. Yes, most yeah. people, a very tiny number, yeah. despite what you see on the television of resuscitations, are successful in hospital and outside hospital. So it's reasonable for decisions to be made not to do something futile that yeah. is undignified. That's entirely different from what is unlawful, but which does happen, yeah. which is heavily patients with a heavy stroke, with a very bleak prognosis, are helped on their way. They're not conscious necessarily, but a decision's been made for them. Now, if they have an advance directive, a so-called living will, they can say that I want no active intervention. But in the absence of that, it's much more difficult. So that is a problem. But I would say
it's
that...
It's a very serious allegation against geriatric and stroke services, Evan. Hmm. And you really need to be able to substantiate that, because you're accusing them effectively of murder, because you're accusing them of contemplating ending a life that would not otherwise have ended, and where there may be treatment that could restore them to active living.
I don't have a rose-tinted spectacle view of the medical profession, because I've looked at the surveys and the published results of doctors being asked whether they have ever and whether they have in the last year, and the results give very large numbers, much larger than the numbers of people who would use assisted suicide.
And can I make a point here, because I think it's really very important that actually in the context where we're talking about people in clinical settings taking decisions which would affect people's lives. And one of the things, reasons why many disabled people are very scared is that do not resuscitate orders go on the end of our beds when they're not necessary because of the fact that we're disabled people.
Exactly.
That's a fact.
You should be asked. I've campaigned for this. That
absolutely.
It should be asked, and people say, oh, it'll be distressing.
Yeah.
But
well,
right
the point,
to be asked about this.
The point is that if we've got this situation already, a change in the law, does it change our culture to allow more people to do more of this?
No, I don't think it does, because it respects autonomy. This is the point I'm making. I'm taking a wholly consistent approach where the autonomy of the competent individual, the patient, is always raised higher, both in the context of being asked whether they want treatment offered to them before it's offered or before it's not going to be offered, and secondly, whether they want, if they meet the criteria, which would be strict in my view for this country, to have assisted dying. And the question that hasn't been answered is, what do you do with someone who isn't dying, who is in despair, but is competent to make the decision, who refuses life-saving treatment? Does Elora, who I greatly admire for her work, does she believe that we should have the right in those cases, no terminal illness, not suffering unbearably, competent, to die because we're not allowed to give them antibiotics?
Can I just come back a little bit earlier on to the point that you were making about autonomy? I think that it is really important that when you have a discussion about autonomy, you also recognise the power of the clinician, the doctor, over the vulnerable patient, and the power of the doctor to persuade them, however subtly, that actually they would be better off down one path or another. If you really want to have that discussion, then have that discussion completely outside the medical care and the medical context in which that person's being treated, so that you drive up the duty on the clinicians to talk to the patient and listen to them and their needs and do all they can to meet those needs. And if you want to have some kind of vetting process, then take it completely outside clinical care, because you will not respect autonomy if you let the person in power over the patient also be involved in that
decision. But I just want to say briefly, because I agree that there's something in that, that if you look at surveys of patients in Holland across Europe, in Holland, where the conversation about assisted death is legal, patients are much more confident that they're able to, they have a better relationship with their doctor because nothing's off bounds. So I think we need to recognise that for some patients, the role of their treating physician is important. But I absolutely agree there have to be safeguards,
second opinion. It's about a taboo of having that, of conversations about what people need and having the courage to listen to their fears.
Can I just ask Debbie about your own experience?
I really respect everything that Baroness Finlay is involved in. However, the point about autonomy is that I have to make decisions. Any of my doctors can offer me two or three drugs to deal with a particular symptom. They all have different side effects, and I am the only person who can decide which ones I can deal with and which are most appropriate. Doesn't always mean the best drug in a particular situation is what I choose to take. I spasm a lot because I prefer to have the pain of a few spasms than the inability to transfer, because the lack of spasticity that the antispasmodic drugs create mean that my actual ability to transfer and move is compromised. So those are my choices. And I, at the moment, it is legal to commit suicide. I didn't know what the figures were, but Baroness Finlay says it's about 57,000 a year in this country.
That's over the 10 years. It's about 3,000 suicides a year.
About 3,000 a year. Then those people, currently people are committing suicide having just, you know, feeling despair, feeling
these aren't the medically ill
by and large. The doctor might say, well, I can't talk to you about this. Have an open and honest discussion, so our relationships with our doctors become better and a framework is in place where palliative care can be offered and improved care can be offered, which is more specific to the person involved, more correct for their situation and the way that they live their lives, then it will improve those situations. I personally can delay making any decisions about the end of my life because I am reasonably confident that I'll be able to ask my husband for assistance if I can still travel to Switzerland. If we had the opportunity for assisted dying, if we properly discuss it, I absolutely agree with David and everybody who said it shouldn't be rushed through, it shouldn't be a fast, you know, popular thing to pass through as Parliament. It's got to be properly discussed. It isn't a political football, it's our lives, and it's got to be discussed properly. Disability is not considered a reason to ask for assisted suicide, and it isn't by the British public. At the moment, we are criticising what happens in Switzerland because Switzerland is the only country that allows United Kingdom residents to make use of their law on assisted dying. Oregon doesn't, Belgium doesn't, Holland doesn't. The only country that allows us to make use of it is Switzerland. So people with the ability, the financial ability and the intellectual desire to go to Switzerland, they can make use of it. Other people can't. And 3,000 people every year decide to end their lives. If only 100 of those people think they can delay it for 6 months or a year or 2 years or forever because they know that they can ask for help and support. And should they go through the safeguards, should they meet the requirements, should they be offered the alternatives that they then try, maybe that will save lives. I think the idea that this is about a right to die is not true. It's about a right to live, about the right for our lives to be treated with respect, that it's our choice about how we live it. It's nobody else's. It's not a doctor. It's not a social worker. and it's not the members of the House of Lords. They can't decide what determines the quality of my life. Only I can do that.
Debbie, can I just ask, Ilora, I mean, on what Debbie's just said, but also specifically on this thing that people feel they need to die before that they would have done otherwise, right, had they been able to do it here.
If you look at the suicides that occur, and there are about 3,000 a year in this country, they are amongst people such as prisoners, they are amongst the bereaved, they are amongst young people who sadly get caught up, as the Bridgend kids did, in a suicide approach. These are not medical precipitated suicides.
Suicide amongst people who are diagnosed with MND and multiple sclerosis are a huge amount higher than the national average. People who are diagnosed with illnesses, particularly incurable, are frightened of the future, and they can choose to take their lives quite legally. They choose to take their lives because of fear of what the future holds.
Okay. And people are frightened as well, because sadly there's a lot of misinformation around. There's been a lot in the press about people with motor neuro disease choking to death. Actually, they don't choke to death. That's not true. It's been a very good post-mortem study has demonstrated too that that isn't how people die. So you can whip up fear in people. But my point earlier on to Evan was precisely that if the doctor or the nurse, who's the person in power, gives a message of despair and actually reinforces the question, would I be better off dead, then you can drive somebody down the road to believing that they would be better off dead, rather than saying, what is it that's making today so awful? What can we do to improve it, however small?
So you're saying in all cases, palliative care and, you know, is a solution, and that it doesn't matter whether people choose not to speak to their doctors or...
Debbie, I would never claim that palliative care has a magic wand and can make things magically better. It can't. People are suffering. Suffering seems to be part of the human existence. But what I'm saying is, if we take away the duty of care within our society, and if we take away the protection of the law from those who are vulnerable, we have to look at what the unintended consequences of that are.
Can I just stop? We've got very little time left. I'm just going to whip round. I just want you to say kind of very short thing on what you think kind of needs to be said about this.
Mary? I think the suggestion that those who are in favour of changing the law on assisted suicide are taking away the duty of care is very, very misleading. I don't think that that is the intention of people who are at all, and it's not even an unintended consequence. I think the idea that one is suggesting that the duty of care will go out of the window is completely wrong.
Okay. Evan?
Well, I would just ask listeners and readers to consider whether, if it was them and they were of sound mind and weren't being coerced and were terminally ill and were suffering unbearably, that they would think, as we know the majority of people do, that they should have the right, after consultation with doctors, after getting it checked with a second opinion, checked for coercion, that they should have the right to choose a death with dignity and not have someone else, whether it be a doctor or a nurse or a politician or even a bishop, telling them that they don't have that right. It is their life.
Okay, thanks. David?
And I think we need to focus on the rights of us all to make choices. I think we really need to have much, much more detailed discussion. I think we should have a national conference looking at this issue, because we are only scratching the surface here. And it's about as... We need to demonstrate, as a society, maximising all of our potential to contribute to society and taking away that fear of dying and allowing people to be in a place where the end of life is as positive as it can be, but focusing on life itself and the potential there.
Okay. And Laura?
I want people to have choices, true choices, so they can live well and they can die well, not that they feel that the only solution to the situation they find themselves in is to foreshorten their life and end their life early, and that we don't frame a law which drives us down that road.
And Debbie, can I ask you?
I seem to have a much more positive view of people than Baroness Finlay does. I don't believe doctors, carers, friends, family members, I don't believe they would acquiesce quickly to a decision to end a life. I believe that people are searching for the best possible way to improve the quality of life. And I think I agree with David as well, though, that we need to discuss really deeply, but we need to have an open mind and not be governed by the idea that any decision and any desire to create a law on assisted dying is automatically a failure. It isn't. It's a positive thing that gives us back our autonomy.
Thank you all very much for your time. And you can read the Observer's coverage of this on Sunday on observer.co.uk.